The Direct Podcast, everything you need to know about the universes you love on a Monday. All the news from all those universes, including reviews of the Guardians of the Galaxy Holiday Special and Rian Johnson's Knives Out Glass Onion, episode 123. Let's get it.
Truth is,
I am a Jedi.
I'm the Vengeance.
And I am Iron Man.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome in, welcome on, and welcome to the second Michael Jordan episode of The Direct Podcast, episode 123. I'm your host, a guy who forgot to come up with a new nickname now that Andor is over, Matt Rimke, fandom expert Matt Rimke.
Hey, yeah.
Joined, as always, by my co-host. You hear that sweet, sultry voice all the way down in Florida. Teacher, friend, guide, pal, box office correspondent, David Thompson.
What's up? We're here. It's a Monday. I'm happy that we're kind of switching things up. It's another page is turned in the Direct Box Office, or the Direct Box Office, that too. Yeah. In the Direct Podcast, I guess, history, ever-growing kind of movement happening here with the Direct Podcast. And you know, we don't have a show for a while, and I think that's going to be really interesting going forward and exciting, I think, for us and hopefully for you listeners that right now listening, that we don't have like this week to week thing right now to look forward to. But that leaves us a lot of room to play and have fun and do different things and get people on and drafts and this and lists and rankings and anything we really want to do. And now this new Monday time as well. So I'm happy to be here, Matt. It's a very exciting time. I'm sad Andor is gone. Well, we've got some exciting things to talk about today too. That we're still getting fed. We're still eating as fans, and we will until the end of this year. There's a lot still to happen.
Absolutely, and you know, well said, well spoken, well thought out, Mr. Thompson. Yeah, like David said, a little bit of house cleaning. Obviously, we are here on a Monday. Very exciting stuff. You know, Disney Plus kind of runs our schedule a little bit. Whenever they have a weekly show, we want to get the reviews and reactions out as soon as we possibly can. So when Disney Plus drops another new show, rather that be Secret Invasion or Mando 3, we will be releasing the day after, per usual, once that happens. But until then, we got 2 months at least until that happens. So we'll be coming to you on Mondays. And for the rest of 2022, we'll be on Mondays. Like David said, no TV shows. But today, we have two reviews of two movies, one theatrical release, one TV special over on Disney Plus. We will be reviewing Avatar: The Way of the Water at the end of the year, and you know, in between all that, we're gonna have some fun drafts. You know, we're gonna be able to take our time a little bit more on the drafts in these next couple weeks, and also we'll be bringing back the bracket. We don't know exactly what we're doing yet, but we will have another bracket by year's end. I can guarantee you that much. And then, of course, at the end of the year, the biggest show of the year, the Direct Awards, where we'll be granting awards, celebrations, and titles to the universes you love for the year 2022. So that's kind of what we have over the next month. And then, of course, 2023, me and David, we're going to sit down, we're going to strap on the helmets, we're going to look to see what we can do more of, what we can do less of, how we can improve this show for anybody listening and anybody following along. If you have any thoughts, ideas, comments, or concerns about the Direct Podcast, please do not hesitate to reach out to me or David, David at David Thompson with two A's over on Twitter, me at Matt Rimke, R-O-E-M-B as in boy, K. E, David, that's enough of our house cleaning. That's enough of the making sure that we got our P's and Q's in order. Our I's and J's are dotted. People forget about the lowercase J. Got to dot that too. You know, it's always dotting I's and crossing T's. What about a J? Got to get that dotted as well. Let's dive into the news from the universes you love, kicking it off with the red brand OJJ.
Spider-Man wasn't attacking the city. He was trying to save it. That's slander.
It is not. I resent that. Slander is spoken. In print, it's libel.
Kicking off with the red brand, some above-the-shoulders studio nonsense, as Marvel Studios usually runs into. Everybody knows about the rights issues with X-Men, Fantastic Four, etc. coming. Spider-Man, of course, with yes. the Marvel Studios and the Marvel Cinematic Universe. For those who don't know, quick refresher, Marvel was on the verge of bankruptcy in the late 90s. And to kind of make ends meet, they sold off the movie and TV rights to their biggest characters. And in the late 90s, early 2000s, those characters were Spider-Man, X-Men, Fantastic Four, The Incredible Hulk, and a few other supplementary characters in that vein. Of course, that's the reason that Iron Man kicked off the MCU, a formerly C-tier comic book character, now one of the biggest names in superhero history, and the rest is just that. History. We know about Spider-Man and Sony and their deal with Marvel Studios to do kind of a layaway renting situation. It's worked out pretty good so far. Yes. We all know that Bob Iger was responsible for bringing in 20th Century Fox into the Disney family, bringing with them the X-Men franchise in its entirety, along with the Fantastic Four. But recent reports have confirmed that there's one character that joins the Incredible Hulk, Bruce Banner, under the Universal flag, and that is Namor. Mm-hmm. And, for those who don't know about the Hulk situation, the idea is that Marvel Studios is willing and able to feature the Hulk in a bunch of different projects, like we've seen in Avengers movies, She-Hulk, obviously, and Thor Ragnarok. But they're not allowed to make a solo project for the Hulk. That is why The Incredible Hulk is brought to you by Universal Studios, the same way Iron Man and Captain America are brought to you by Paramount.
Right.
So it has been officially confirmed by The Wrap, who, again, is just having the busiest couple of weeks, that Namor falls under that same category. Namor, obviously, after Black Panther Wakanda Forever, is allowed to be featured in the MCU made by Marvel Studios, but a Namor solo project currently is not on the table. Reports do say that that deal, that contract, that situation does end in June of next year. So look for Marvel Studios to make a play and make that more of a possibility. David, the industry news for the Red Brand. How do we, do you have any reaction, thoughts, or concerns with Namor under that Hulk banner not being able to get a solo project?
Hulk banner. Nice.
Shit, that was awesome. Come on. Should we just wrap it up? Guys, that's been a great podcast. Thank you. I'm going to retire, actually. I'm going to hang up the mic.
That's it.
The Hulk banner.
Honestly, I think I haven't commented at all. We talk a lot at the direct. We were kind of a close-knit group generally, and there wasn't much discussion on this. And I know we're discussing it right now. This has kind of been a known thing, at least to me, someone who kind of follows this stuff rather closely. Like, Namor has been one of those. Namor was always described to me as one of those characters, because these rights deals, people, like Matt laid it out earlier, they are a mess because of what happened in the late 90s. I think it was 98 they almost filed bankruptcy, and like 99 is when they did all the selling, and then they Sony quickly greenlit Spider-Man. Yeah.
X-Men went into production just like 2-3 months after they sold off the rights to Fox.
Yeah,
so that's how quickly that happened.
I think X-Men is the first like sold Marvel property. Absolutely. That got a movie. Yeah. So, and then Spider-Man, obviously, all those movies.
And Blade, but that's different.
Blade, because it wasn't a full on sell. I think New Line did that.
Yes, the one with the blue little wood drift mark.
And I think that was before New Line was. This is back in the day when all these smaller studios weren't owned by larger companies.
So Orion.
It was a little bit different. But in general, like how it was always, getting back to it, how it was always described to me is these things get messy. And Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver were one of these two characters that were equally shared between Fox, went before Disney owned Fox, and Disney, right? And in Disney, it was basically described as you can use the characters, their abilities, all this stuff, but you can't say mutant. You can't make them like an X-Men. They can just be there. And they did, right? We had multiple Quicksilvers happening at the same time on the big screen that were completely different characters. Namor was described to me as that, where there's kind of an equal sharing feel. I guess now this report kind of just simplified things where it is like a Hulk situation, or a lot of different characters, I guess, that we have. Because technically, even Spider-Man, like animated Spider-Man show, you know, Spider-Man freshman year, that's just a Marvel Studios project because they can. It's not a feature film going out into, you know, on the big screen or anything like that, like Spider-Verse, let's say. That's like the difference there. And it's all I would love to read the contracts. It's so interesting to me. But with Namor, I don't find this as much of an issue. Universal has been very, let's say, I don't know,
liberal.
They kind of sit on their hands is how I describe them. They're not like Sony, where they're actively trying to build out the Spider-Man everything and just milk that cash cow as much as possible. It's not Hulk, Namor is not that too Universal. Like they don't really rely on Hulk. They're not trying to, like, all of a sudden we don't have like Hulk and Red Hulk and all this stuff going on at Universal separate from Marvel Studios. That's not how they roll. They would rather just kind of share the rights kind of and work through it. And maybe there is a possibility where Hulk could get back to Disney, or that Universal could produce another Marvel Studios picture, a la, you know, Sony, Columbia Pictures producing No Way Home, Homecoming, Far From Home, all that good stuff. I don't think this is a problem. I think Namor is a villain that was used in Wakanda Forever very well, and they can't use his name in a title, just like they can't use Hulk's name in a title. And that could get tricky, because I could see that being an avenue going forward. I could also see where someone would like to see a Namor solo project. But to me, they don't need to. And if I'm Disney, just like with Hulk, they have utilized Kevin Feige, Disney, Bob Iger, whoever you want to talk about over at Disney the last 10 years, have used Hulk in such a brilliant way. Like, he is a mainstay staple of the MCU. And he doesn't have in the last 14 years, doesn't have a solo film. Yet he's been a co-star, a main character in so many films, Avengers, Thor Ragnarok, all these things, appearing in She-Hulk. Like, he has his fingerprints all over the MCU, yet they don't have to pay, basically, to make his own movies, you know? And Universal just sits there, like I said, sitting on their hands, not actively, like, causing a scene or, you know, causing issues, and just kind of letting it happen, right? So I think that's a very similar situation to Namor. I do think if Disney were given the option to then acquire Namor entirely, just like they would with literally any of these other characters, because it's a whole different story for Disney and Marvel now than Marvel was back in the early 2000s and late 90s. Right now, they wish they had all their characters, obviously. That's an obvious statement. So if it were to be, you know, kind of up for grabs, Namor, the likeness of his character, sure, I imagine they would try to acquire them. But even then, I'm not sure personally, in terms of the MCU, how that would even change their navigation of this character. Because I think he will be mixed in with other projects going forward. Like, maybe Disney Plus, things like that. But I don't really see them greenlighting a straight up Namor movie. Black Panther Wakanda Forever is like half a Namor movie. So just go watch that, you know? So I don't know. We'll see how this, you know, unravels, if ever really does. I do like getting these updates, appreciate it from the wrap on all these things. The next big thing, I think, in this topic, hopefully that we talk about next, Matt, will be whatever happens with Spider-Man next and Tom Holland, because there's been rumors flying around, but nothing is confirmed. And I am not booking anything as confirmed until I really see it from a trade or by Sony and Disney officially.
As you shouldn't. So many things go off of there. I'm trying to pick which one. I think, you know, for me personally, like a Namor solo movie, I think would absolutely crush. I think it would be an awesome thing. I think that was like weirdly a critique I got, at least like from some of my friends, about Wakanda Forever, was like, well, I don't care as much about Tolokan as I care about Wakanda. Like, you know, like, all that stuff. Like, well, yeah, you know, it was barely in this movie. You know, it was featured in this movie the same way Wakanda has been featured in other movies. We're getting a Namor project at some point to explore that more. I think this is special presentation gold if they just want to focus on Tolokan specifically. Obviously, budgetary, you know, we got to figure that out. But I think a Namor solo movie would do really well. It would be the first anti-hero movie in the MCU, which could be a very cool thing. But I do expect Marvel Studios to be aggressive next June when these rights are a little more up for grabs, so to speak, to lock down the Hulk, lock down Namor, because World War Hulk and a Namor project, I think, are two layups for phase six, something that we can get to really build towards Secret Wars in even a more way. And I'm going to keep saying this over the next couple years if this podcast continues to chug along like it has been. Building the different pockets, the different branches of the MCU, I think is going to be the most creative and effective way to make Secret Wars feel like it does in the comics. Because in the comics, it's all these different universes and teams coming together. In the MCU, it's a little bit more, well, everybody's an Avenger. So, you know, what do you mean different teams, stuff like that?
Right.
I think that building different pockets is going to be what they want to do. And Warhawk and Namor, two very easy, effective ways to do that. People got to remember, I mean, not even remember, but people should know, in the original Secret Wars from 1985, Hulk was an individual entry into the Secret Wars battle, just like Spider-Man, just like Iron Man, just like, you know, the Fantastic Four, X-Men, Avengers. Hulk, Spider-Man, Iron Man, they all came in individually, not attached to any team.
Right. It
allowed for, you know, the six different branches of the Marvel Universe to come together, Hulk being one of his own, same as Spider-Man.
Right.
And also, people forget, James Rhodes was Iron Man in Secret Wars, not Tony Stark. Tony Stark had retired at the time. It was a very cool storyline in the original Secret Wars. I love that book.
Not enough retirements in the MCU. Just retire. Like Cap just retires.
Sure. You know? Well, I mean, Tony tried.
Can't. True.
You know, then Ultron, my fault.
Yeah. That's a great point. That's a great point.
I love Tony Stark. I love Tony Stark.
You know, it's funny you mentioned it. Like, it is crazy. 2022, almost 2023 right now. The fact that Iron Man is one of the most just well-known, renowned, loved superheroes of all time. And it's all just RDJ, MCU. Like, he is the staple for a cinematic superhero. And that's really it. Like, no one gives a shit still about an Iron Man comic book. No, like, even the biggest... Exactly. And everyone cares so much about this character. That's such a unique pocket that Iron Man only has, in my opinion.
I will throw one more name out there that has that in spades, in my opinion. That's Doctor Strange. Doctor Strange never carried a comic book, to my knowledge. Like he's had one-offs that are great. Ant-Man, you can say the same, but they've always been so tied to the Avengers, the Pyms in the comics. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like they're so ingrained in the Avengers stuff.
That right.
Ant-Man comic, you know, Avengers comics are Ant-Man comics, especially the Hank Pym stuff.
Right. Exactly.
But yeah, it's Iron Man and Strange for me. That just, it's so fascinating how a movie can do a character so much good. And I think it comes down to casting in a lot of ways. You know,
yeah,
you
come definitely. With Ashton
Downey. You know, you can't beat it. Speaking of casting, speaking of big name actors, well, not actors, right? Quentin Tarantino said that these aren't actors, these are characters.
Right.
Love Quentin Tarantino. I think his quote was taken incredibly out of context.
It was, right? God.
He wasn't saying that these actors aren't better actors than the actors of old. It was the movie industry focuses more on franchises, IPs, and reoccurring characters. Therefore, the actors have a harder time standing alone.
Which it
That's
does.
That's all he was saying. It's true. It's 100% true. He said it in a very gritty and, you know, like, you know, not holding back way. It's Quentin fucking Tarantino. How else do you expect him to talk?
Think about young actors, like any... Like Tom Holland, Spider-Man, that's like the first thing you think. Honestly, a name like Zendaya sticks out as like someone who's kind of above, like she's her own star. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I think you look at the, you know, this core we have with Zendaya, Chalamet, Holland, you know, Florence Pugh to some extent. You know, I know she's a little more indie, but
I'd
like,
say
you
she's
know,
getting
Millie
there.
Bobby, Millie yeah. Bobby Brown coming right. up. She's one blockbuster away from, you know, really breaking that out. You know, she wasn't Godzilla. But like, I think we are getting that idea from Holland and Zendaya specifically across a bunch of, and that's the thing, they're franchise hopping. You know, Holland's right. Uncharted, Zendaya's Dune. Holland just got tapped for a Citizen Kane remake. That's the biggest movie of all time. So I do think it's swinging back the other way. But he's right. You know, Chris Hemsworth specifically, somebody we're going to talk about here, he is more known for Thor than anything else, and that's just the idea of Hollywood. He's been in 9 Thor movies. like that, that's how it's going to happen. Chris Hemsworth, we all love him. We all know him. He shares a birthday with me, August 11th. Good birthday, Chris. Good stuff. he recently spoke about the Thor franchise while promoting his Mad Max prequel, which is going to be cool. We'll review that, I think. I haven't seen Mad Max since theaters.
Yeah.
Pretty good, if I remember. He recently spoke about the Thor franchise. Another quote I think was taken out of context. He basically said, you look at Thor 1 and Thor 2, and they're pretty similar, which is true. You look at Ragnarok and Love and Thunder, and they're pretty similar, also true. It's about reinventing it. He wants to come back and reinvent something. A lot of people took that and ran with it as, oh, Chris Hemsworth is sick of Taika Waititi. He wants to go back to what Thor 1 and 2 were. I don't think that's what he's saying. I think he's just saying, you know, we've done two movies that are the same. We've done another two movies that are the same. What's the next level? If he's going to come back for an 11th Thor appearance, he wants to reinvent it. He wants to do something new.
Yep.
David, if Hemsworth came back for another movie, let's not, like, you know, if he comes back in an Avengers role or some sort of mentor role, that's different, right? Shows up in a Guardians movie. If there was a Thor 5, what tone, what idea, what aesthetic would you want to see approached outside of the, you know, the pop art Taika style or the more dramatic Shakespearean of the first two?
Yeah, I mean, they'd have to go away from Taika, I think, because Love and Thunder, a movie that has aged poorly for me, but a movie that I still would say I enjoy and I thought was good. And I think a lot of people say that. A lot of people think it's trash and bad and all this. Taika didn't have any, he was not reined in at all on that movie. Like, and he went full on humor, even though, in my opinion, I do think that the serious, sad moments really work. And I thought Gore was great as well. And I thought Natalie Portman was a star. For Thor 5, this has to be the final chapter. This has to be a lot of finality to it. And I honestly, Matt, I don't see a Thor 5 happening. I would be surprised if it did right now. I'm just not sure when it would happen. And I don't know what the story would be, because I feel like, and I think this is the feeling that Hemsworth is getting, we can't keep reinventing the wheel with Thor, right? Like, we had those, like, I feel like in many ways, those first two movies are very much so kind of cast aside amongst himself, fans, Marvel. They're just like, oh, and then we had Ragnarok that kind of rewired and recreated Thor. And now after Love and Thunder, I hear what he's saying, where it's like, we need to, you know, kind of rubber band it back, bend it back a little bit. We got to go back to at least something a bit more serious in its tone, because it's the tone in Love and Thunder that I think people mainly don't like, and just how goofy and hammy and jokey it is. I think making the story smaller would be a good place to start. Like, and I mean really small.
As small, like, as you can with Thor.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But not a bunch of, like, not a bunch of earth jumping and all of this. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's just him in love. Like, maybe it's a small story about, you know, him and his daughter or something, and just how he has it's finally his time. I don't know. But I do understand from his perspective, because honestly, if you think about it, in my opinion, Thor peaked in Infinity War. Between Ragnarok and Infinity War, I mean, he's good in Endgame too, but then we get, you know, Love and Thunder. Like, the MCU arc for Thor peaked in Infinity War, in my opinion. Like, his acting was amazing. The way the Russos were directing him was awesome. Just that conversation with him and Rocket on the ship. God!
Exactly. The players he's with in that movie do so much for him.
Yes, I completely agree. And it's like, but it's a perfect moment for him and, like, who he is and what he's gone through, and, like, seeing Loki die finally and all this. So anyway, beyond that, I just think for a Thor 5, if there were going to be a Thor 5, I agree with Hemsworth in the sense that they'd have to, it can't be Taika. It's not going to be a Taika trilogy. They've got to not go back to Thor 1 and 2. Like, you can't, right? That's like a whole different,
so distant
universe now too. Like, there's no Asgard. There's none of this. I don't know what it would be, and I don't think it's going to happen, but it would have to be something final. This would be like the final chapter. They would, like, I think it would be marketed as that, like the final Thor movie, the final chapter in Thor's book. And that would be cool. Thor 5. I think that would be awesome, but I don't see it happening. I just don't.
Yeah, I think Thor is such an interesting character when you break it down like that, right? Because, I mean, just from the language you see, like, Ragnarok, and people want to talk about retroactively how Taika ruined Thor. I've studied every single list of every MCU website creator, reporter, everything across the internet. Ragnarok is a perennial top 5 movie, or a top 10 movie, I should say. You know what I mean? It's hard to find it outside of a top 10 list. And when you do, it's in the bottom 10. So that kind of shows the extremist nature of it. I think that, you know, people want to shit on Taika for quote unquote ruining Thor after Love and Thunder. People got to remember, you don't get Infinity War Thor without Ragnarok. The style, yes, the tone, the humor, like, you know, I know it's dark and sad and he's got that conversation with Rocket. He's genuinely funny in that movie. All mm-hmm. words are made up. You don't get that from an old Thor. He's still funny, but he's funny in a fish out of water kind of way in those first two movies. And, you know, people want to give shit to Elizabeth Olsen for switching up her accent so much. He quite literally changes from a Shakespearean British accent in Thor Dark World and the Avengers movies into an Australian accent in Thor Ragnarok. He's just more Australian now. And I think that that tone of the character, I think that is something that should be continued, that should be latched onto. The tone of the movie, I think, is where Love and Thunder kind of ran into it a little bit. It was a comedy, you know, and Thor Ragnarok, as funny as it is, it's got that Guardians, Iron Man, Joss Whedon, Avengers kind of special sauce where it's funny, even though it's not like jokey. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, you know, those movies are funny organically. Love and Thunder was a little more written to be funny, which, you know, was a little bit more of the extreme tone. But like you said, Taika wasn't reined in because this was one for them. You know, this is the fourth Thor movie. It's not going to impact the MCU in a very big way, at least in the immediate sense. This is a just let's have fun with Thor movie. I get it. Moving into Thor 5, I think that a God of War kind of tone, you know, more serious. I think getting back to that Infinity War kind of balance between the comedy and the serious and the dramatic acting. The only problem is, you know, Thor's got no more hardships to go through. He's lost his planet. He's lost his family. He's lost his people. What's going to drag him down to that? That's something that they're going to have to figure out narratively. But that kind of more video game style of movie for Thor, I think, could be very cool. And I think that's something Hemsworth could latch on to and just kind of have a little bit more of a Infinity War presence that we saw from Hemsworth there.
I think God of War is a good shout. I think Hemsworth's Logan, right? A Thor Logan would be
something like that. Yeah.
That's kind of, I think an like old grizzled. Yeah, sure. Sure. I just think that that kind of idea where it's like gritty, it's feels more real, maybe it's even bloody, like it's not magic and lights and colors, it's more just serious, and it ends with him dying in a heroic way. And that's the thing too, they've kind of run out, like they've kind of drained the well a certain extent of like his characters in the MCU, like everyone has died that he's like had any relation to pretty much now. Which is sad, and he's a tragic character, but it leaves you with minimal room for growth, essentially.
Yeah, and I don't remember who pointed this out. I think it was one of the Barstool guys. But, like, Thor's arc did wrap up. Like, Endgame was the end of Thor's character arc. That being, you know, that being losing everybody, overcoming that, you know, dealing with it in Ragnarok and Infinity War. People forget all the emotional beats in Ragnarok, too. And then obviously Endgame, the depression, the alcoholism, overcoming that, don't say his name. That was the end of his character arc. So Love and Thunder being a more just fun romp makes a lot of sense because, and we can get into this deeper in a different date, but like changing the arc of the last movie just to make a movie that has another interesting arc, I don't think is beneficial. It's the Spider-Man thing. You know what I mean? If Spider-Man shows up in his next movie and takes his mask off right away, what was the point of No Way Home? That's kind of the idea, I think, with Love and Thunder. If he had to lose somebody again, you know, what would really be the point of Endgame and all that? So that's been talking Thor. What's up? Do we have numbers?
We got the numbers, Matt. The numbers have come in as of recording. So, and I am, my heart is warm with these Wakanda Forever numbers. So we're at weekend three. Not Christmas, Thanksgiving weekend. So there was a lot of promise. There was a lot of, I guess, hype for someone like me that's looking forward to hopefully having a huge long-term gross box office run for Wakanda Forever. It only dropped, this is in weekend three, the three-day weekend, only dropped 31% from weekend two. Nice. So we're in weekend three of Wakanda Forever. and that is a $45.9 million 3-day weekend domestically. We are now at $367.7 million, not globally, but totally at the domestic box office so far. It'll surely pass that 400 mark probably next week, I want to say. That sounds about right. And here's the thing. I tweeted about this, but I want to make sure my thoughts are clear here in the podcast too. I think this movie can still make $1 billion. And I think that is kind of a buzzy word, right? A billion. Like that really doesn't mean much. Like, you kind of just want to make the studio money at the end of the day. Like Multiverse of Madness made like 950, which is awesome. That is a great run. And I keep seeing industry projections, which, by the way, were lowballing this weekend. The domestic box office, it blew projections out of the water to some extent.
Shout out Warner Brothers.
Right. We are at $675.6 million globally. Okay, so we're almost at $700 million. We still have time, is my point. There's still so much time until Avatar comes out. Weeks until Avatar comes out. And there's really nothing. There's nothing out there. Someone show me what's really going to like nail Wakanda Forever, because this is an enjoyable, loved movie right now. Like, people are really going out to the theater and seeing it. And yeah, what do you have to say, Matt?
I just think, going off that just really quickly, the biggest competition it had on its entire run was a movie we're going to talk about later today, Glass Onion. And, yeah, you know, that's only a week and theaters are packed for, yeah, Glass Onion. And with a 31% drop, I think it overcame its biggest hurdle. So it's, you know, smooth sailing here on out.
And Glass Onion, even like me personally, like in my hometown, at my local AMC, they weren't showing it. I had to go to Orlando to see it, you know? So that's like, it's not a wide release, Glass Onion. That's why theaters are packed, at least to some extent, in my opinion. Sure. The interest is there, of course. I think the limited premium kind of way this is kind of marketed and presented as, oh, it's gonna be on Netflix, but at a very limited
in a
time
month.
Yeah, right, like let's go check it out in the theater. No, I agree, definitely some competition there, but even then, the Glass Onion seems very like it's supplemental for Netflix. Unfortunately, I wish Glass Onion had this huge wide release. It's really not getting it. I'm very curious, like you said, theaters are packed. I am very curious to see those numbers when they come out. But Wakanda Forever, back to it, I genuinely think we'll make more than Multiverse of Madness, and no one else is saying that. I haven't seen anyone else be like, oh, this is gonna make over 950, because that is a high number. But I don't see how it's gonna just tail off so quickly, because Multiverse of Madness tailed off really quickly and it still grossed that much, and it didn't have China. Black Panther doesn't have China, and that's a big part too, but we'll see. I think they're projecting like 850 to 900 in that area, so it would globally make less than Multiverse of Madness. I don't know. I have faith. I have this gut feeling, I guess, but gut feeling as well as just some critical thought that I don't see how this movie makes less than Multiverse of Madness, even though it very well may. So if it makes more, that $1 billion mark is right there. So I'm not ruling out $1 billion yet. And I'm very much looking forward to continually watching this and monitoring. And this weekend was a good testament for how many people were still interested in seeing this movie and will remain to be. I do think there's some rewatchability and just more people just wanting to go see it for the first time.
Sure.
We'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm excited to keep an eye on it. I do want to ask you real quick before we move on to our reviews. You're optimistic about $1 billion. I understand that. What is your floor, though? You know, like what's your low ball on where this could hit? Are we talking like nines are looking safe, or more of that mid eights kind of range?
Yeah.
What's the variability there?
My floor. Yeah, there's some variability. That's a good question. I would say the floor is around like 870 million globally. That's just my rough estimate. Mm-hmm. That's the range I see. If you're gonna make it like a $100 million range, it's like 870 to 970. That's kind of where I'm looking at it right now.
Okay,
throwing in the fun idea that it could maybe hit $1 billion possibly.
The potential's there. The risk, the higher ceiling is there for right. Sure. It's gonna be crazy if Multiverse Madness makes more than Wakanda Forever. I just think right? That's gonna be nuts.
That's what, and it seems like
it just puts question into not obviously not the validity of the box office. That's how success is measured in movies. But like, you won't find, I haven't found a person who has Multiverse of Madness over Wakanda Forever from a ranking standpoint. So it was so interesting. I don't know. I guess it had that multiverse pull.
Yeah. It had a lightning. It had a really hot opening weekend, but then it dipped off. Wakanda Forever is not dropping off as hard as. Yeah. Doctor Strange. Yeah, Doctor Strange still made so much money. So we'll see. It's not a perfect science, but I'm excited to maybe in a couple of weeks kind of check back in on this and be like, hey, where are we? Right?
Probably the week before Avatar. We'll check back in and, you know, just kind of have a final moment of silence for Wakanda Forever.
Yeah.
Speaking of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, has been a very Marvel-heavy day. We're going to continue that, ladies and gentlemen, the Guardians of the Galaxy holiday special. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome in to the Guardians of the Galaxy holiday special review. We are back in the James Gunn Guardians of the Galaxy universe, and I'm very excited to be here. The second special presentation from Marvel Studios in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, released, of course, on Disney Plus, directed and written by James Gunn, starring, you know, the players you know and love: Dave Bautista, Pom Clementeef, Karen Gillan, Bradley Cooper. Why am I forgetting? Chris Pratt, of course. Pratt, Sean Gunn.
Yeah.
And the infamous, not infamous, the incredibly famous and respected and loved 7 Degrees of Kevin Bacon. our second special presentation. David, your overall thoughts on the Guardians of the Galaxy holiday special.
I really, really enjoyed this. I had a great time with it. I think these special presentations are very unique and special. We'll talk about them more, but just focusing on this little 40-minute presentation, it flew by. It felt like a long episode of TV. It felt less like a movie, whereas Werewolf by Night, I felt more like a short movie. This one felt like kind of like a long episode of TV. It's so much fun. I thought that the music was good. I thought the action was actually pretty fun, like Mantis jumping around and Drax and all these things. Kevin Bacon, my mom was nearby when I turned it on Friday, and she's like, how'd they get him to do this? And I'm like, I don't know. I mean,
Mickey Mouse dollars, bro.
It pays. Yeah. But yeah, it was a great time. I thought Mantis was kind of the star for me. And in general, I loved the new look of Groot. It's so interesting. I can't wait to see more of this like brooding, big, steroid up Groot in future projects and Guardians 3 and stuff. Speaking of Guardians 3, I thought it was a really fun little like nugget side story in between, you know, where we saw them in Love and Thunder. Like the Guardians, I feel like since Volume 2, we've just gotten glimpses, right? Infinity War, Endgame, Love and Thunder, the holiday special, and finally it's like we're finally 5 years later going to get in May the final chapter, you know, and really dive in back to these characters, which we haven't really properly been able to dive into in years. So all that being said, I thought it worked very well. I thought for what they were trying to achieve, what Gunn was trying to do here, it was like 10 out of 10, because there, you know, the ceiling wasn't like anything incredible or anything insane in terms of like MCU stuff, but I thought it worked brilliantly. I really, really enjoyed this special. And I think it works well. It's just a holiday special, you know, for like the, besides this being an MCU project, it works pretty well. It's just like a Christmas thing, you know. Yeah. It's got a cute, simple, basic story with a lot of, a lot of great MCU Easter eggs and cameos and little know-hows, right? If you know everything, oh man, it's fun. Mm-hmm. But even if you don't, it's a good time, I think, as just like a simple little holiday special in like the Marvel alien universe.
Yeah, the cosmics. It's so great to be back with the Guardians under James Gunn. It's so interesting, you know, how you mentioned how it's been so long since we've really gotten to see this crew on their own. With Gunn behind the pen and, you know, them working with each other and all these things. If you ever rewatch the MCU, which, David, I haven't mentioned, I'm starting an MCU rewatch.
Ooh.
Today. Yeah. Wow. It's for those who don't know, it's 2.5 months until Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania, and that will be the longest gap between content we get until the end of Phase 6. So this is the best time to watch the MCU over again if you are so inclined.
I love that. I want to shout something out. It's we work at thedirect.com. I talk to you all the time, talk to other people that really love and know this stuff deeply. It's fun sometimes talking to, you know, like I quote unquote normal people, I guess those that don't write
general talk, audiences,
you know, for, you know, a living. General audiences. Everyone thinks Quantumania that I've seen looks really good. Everyone's like the trailer pops up in a theater. Ooh, that looks good. You know, and I love that. I feel like I haven't seen that in a little while. There was that for Black Panther, but there's something I think special about Quantumania that's getting people's attention. Maybe it's just Kang, but I think it might be the music too.
It might be Yellow Brick Road.
That trailer is something special. Like in a theater, I saw it in IMAX. It's really good time. Like it is a very well put together. And Marvel, man, they have some good trailers. But I'm looking forward to that one. I'm excited for you and maybe follow along with your journey. I'm not going to go back in for all of it. That kudos to you, but no, I'm excited.
I have a wife who works as a ICU night nurse. Shout out Rosario Dawson. So I have, you know, 3 to 4 nights a week where it is just me and the dog. And, you know, if I don't have plans going on, I'm going to throw a Marvel movie in. Why not? Yeah. It works out with the schedule. Swinging it back around to, you know, when you do an MCU rewatch in like chronological order, if you've ever done that, you know, it is best to watch Guardians 1 and 2 back to back, just because they happen months apart, you know, that canonically that's the move. I don't think it's super important, but if you do that, think about it, man, you get Guardians 2 before Age of Ultron, and then you don't see them again until space in Infinity War and Rubber Band Man comes on.
Yeah.
So like that space has always been like they're back. Like, I love it. This is them. We're here. And that's what this holiday special felt like to me. I think that it's just great to see Mantis and Drax get the shine that they haven't gotten in previous movies. Even though I do think that they are great supporting characters, this is a chance for them to kind of not move up a whole tier, but move up within the tier that they're in, I think, you know, in a Wong kind of way, where, you know, he's not breaking through any tiers, but he is, you know, leading the tier that he's a part of, that being supporting characters. I think Drax and Mantis both move closer to the Wong range than not in that ranking. I think that what this holiday special showed me was the same thing that Werewolf by Night showed me with these special presentations. If they commit to a genre, style, and tone, and don't just do it, like do it 110%, like overdo it almost, like really stylize this thing in the direction they're going, throw in some good writing in that classic Marvel Studios production, in the music and the acting and the costumes and all those things, set design, that's where these things shine for me. You know, Werewolf by Night committing so much to the horror noir, and I just think it works so well. This one committing so much to the campy holiday special, down to the animation. It's a really awesome thing that they're able to do in these 45-minute blocks. I'm concerned about the legs of the special presentation, because how many like specific niche genres can you know, really dive into like that? I'm sure there's great stories to tell in 45 minutes, but so far the hyper stylization of these genres has really what shined for me and made these things work, because you accept them for what they are at that point. You're not going to compare them to Endgame because it's so different. Mm-hmm. You know, there's literally a cartoon in this. So, you know, comparing it to Endgame would be stupid. So I like how they're committing to their niche and moving forward with it. And then of course you mentioned it, the music. It's just it the elevation these Guardians projects get from these scores and needle drops that are in these projects, it sets the floor so high for Guardians for me. So I love it. Very excited. Let's dive into some Michael Keaton spoilers.
Now you want to get nuts? Come on, let's get nuts.
All right, here we are, the Guardians of the Galaxy holiday special spoilers. David, first thing I want to touch on. The animation used for the flashback scenes with Yondu and a young Quill teaching aliens what Christmas is, which I think is a very cool thing. James Gunn had a tweet He said, no offense to Mark Hamill and everybody involved, but he wanted to do the Star Wars Holiday Special right. And for those who don't know, the infamous Star Wars Holiday Special, considered one of the worst things ever made. It is spliced in with animation and real life, and it just didn't really work. James Gunn made it work. And so, David, just quickly, I wanted to see what your thoughts were on the animation being used for the flashbacks here, really wrapping in that holiday special vibe.
Yeah, I thought it was great. I thought it was really well done. And I think it made sense, like trying to find another kid actor to be like the young Star-Lord, because you can't get the same kid, because that was 8 years ago that would have been like the timeline for that child. I think it was probably a different voice actor. Obviously it was Michael Rooker, right? As Yondu, of course.
Yondu.
It said that in the credits. Okay. Yeah. I was making sure it was actually him. Yeah. They paid him. They got him back. And
maybe, I don't know. James Gunn just has his friends in his movies. They might not get paid. We don't know.
Maybe.
Floor Bjorn from the Suicide Squad, Javelin, also in this movie. Just shout out him real quick. He's nice. The bartender on Earth. How the hell would I know where Kevin Bacon is?
Yeah, that was, I love Fish Out of Water, stuff like that. It was so good. That was so goofy. What were you talking about?
The animation.
The animation. Yeah. Sorry. I thought it was really well done. I thought it kind of gave us another little pocket look at that early relationship with, you know, Star-Lord, Peter and Yondu, which helps further the development that, you know, comes to an end in volume 2. And I thought it was like, I didn't even think twice about it. I think that's a really positive thing. Like, it didn't take me out. It kind of made sense. I'm like, oh, holiday special, right? This makes some sense. The voices weren't like weird. The animation was perfectly just like fine. Nothing crazy, nothing weird and 3D and bubbly. Just looked good. Got the point across, right? We were trying to get to a certain point, push the plot to a certain point, give us an understanding. It was story time, you know? And animation always is kind of story time, like that. You know? And that worked well.
I like that a lot. That's a great way to put it. When I first saw it, I was like, I enjoyed it. I didn't have any problems with it. I was wondering why it wasn't claymation at first, because this is a holiday special, you know, Christmas. Let's do some claymation. And then I saw the tweet about the Star Wars holiday special trying to kind of emulate that. So I totally understand the 2D-ness of it then. I like the story time thing. I don't have anything to add. You know, after that, I think that's the perfect way to put it. I did get a pop for me at the end where Peter was like, I don't think Kraglin knows the end of that story. And then we cut back to the animation. I'm like, what an amazing transition.
Yeah.
To like a more emotional beat heading into the animation was such a jarring's not the right word, but like a whoa, like nice, you know, subverting expectations kind of moment, because you know, you're usually thinking, oh, we're going to have fun. No, the emotional beat heading into the second cartoon. Very cool. And then, of course, we get the Marvel Studios fanfare with all of the Santa Marvel Comics scrolls instead of just the regular one that we usually get with the Snicket and everything.
Yeah.
I thought that was cool because Santa is a very big part of Marvel Comics in a lot of ways. A mutant, you know, we'll see it someday, I'm sure. because wasn't that the post-credit scene? Like, we got to have another one, I guess.
Yeah, right.
Santa's coming at the next one. He has to. I do just want to shout out my favorite part of this holiday special off the top. The original song that the 97 wrote for this TV show or TV special, whatever. I don't know what Christmas is, but Christmas time is here.
Yep.
Instantly a top 10 Christmas song for me. I love it. I love everything about it. I love the rhythm and the beat and all that stuff. You know, the 97 rock kind of, you know, not punk, like alternative punk kind of vibe to it. Da-na-na-na-na-na-na. I love all that. I love the lyrics. I think it's funny. I think it pops. But the concept of it, David, is really what I was just drawn into immediately. Aliens who heard from a friend of a friend of a friend who heard from an 8-year-old from Earth what Christmas is. Like telephone through an 8-year-old's perspective of Christmas. And then it turns into things like, you know, if you're on his naughty list, he'll shoot missiles at your toes. He'll hurl sugar plums at your head. You know,
right.
Epic soup. You know, he's a master at picking locks. All those things, you know, just, you know, the vague idea of Christmas being, you know, wrapped again and again and again for an alien. I think it's just so damn funny. You know, the elf One's a dentist. Now he's sleeping with a fish. Like what a crude, you know, recap of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. I think right. That's just so cool. And then my favorite one is, what the hell's a turtle dove and who lit up that deer? You know, because these are questions nobody has asked.
Right.
I don't know what Christmas is. I adore that song, and it had me smiling from ear to ear for the rest of the special. It's we talk about tone setters a lot with these comic book movies. That's a tone setter for me, that just, this is going to be an alien's perception of Christmas after they've been told from an 8-year-old what that right. is. I just think it's so awesome. So
yeah,
that's my biggest piece of good popcorn, if we have one, is the opening song. I don't know what Christmas is, but Christmas time is here.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I thought that all that was great. Honestly, if I had like one thing that was my favorite moment, or like biggest, like big popcorn, was when I guess was like, just diving into this part of the whole story, when Drax and Drax and Mantis arriving on Earth, and like the cloaking device isn't on, then yeah. they're like, just their whole journey is just hilarious yeah. to me, right?
They're walking fish out of water.
Yeah, they're walking around Hollywood. They think, and there's all these like dressed up Ant-Man and Steve, you know, Steve! Like that, that guy's terrified. And they're like getting all the money, and they go to a bar, and they're getting drunk, and they're having fun. And then what I thought was honestly the most hilarious and interesting part was when they go to Kevin Bacon's house finally. And that lady rips them off like the pamphlet. They figure it out.
Pulls it out of the freaking thing outside yeah. the store. That'd be yeah. $40.
Love it. Taking advantage of those that don't know. Foreigners. Yeah. Anyway. Foreigners. They walk. They get to Kevin Bacon's house. And then he, just how terrified he is about the whole situation, I thought was so good. And like confused. And they bust in. They like run after him. It was just, I thought it was so well crafted, in the sense of like that fish out of water story, then leading up to this kind of like hostage situation, and the police come and all this. I don't know. Yeah. I thought it was hilarious. And then what I thought was interesting about it, I mentioned it kind of at the top, is how it felt like a short or a long TV episode. Cause once yeah. we get through that, once they get Kevin Bacon, it goes really quick to the end, you know, mm-hmm. getting back to nowhere, right? And showing, you know, Peter and them hypnosising him, whatever you call it.
Kevin Bacon out of the trance.
yeah. And his yeah. and Kevin Bacon's reaction then. And then
you're not gonna run, right?
Yeah, right. What's so cool, I think, about this whole special in general is that, and I mentioned it earlier, it's like, if you know Marvel, if you are a big Marvel fan, this makes it so much better, because we did get that fundamental moment of Mantis revealing first to Drax and to the audience that, oh, I am Ego's offspring too. I am Peter's sister. And then Peter's reaction to her finally telling him that, and him being like, that's the best gift I could ever had, when she was so nervous about it, right? Because mm-hmm. she thought she would be a reminder of all this pain and sorrow that he has. And that's a big part of the story too in the special, is that Peter is like sad, you know.
Yeah,
you can tell in this Chris Pratt's character, he's not kind of begrudging, just kind of going through the motions, doing like just kind of going through work, it seems like, just kind of doing his like Guardians work that he's done now on nowhere, just kind of going through it, but not like enjoying life. Like he has his Guardians family, but obviously that doesn't have Gamora in it anymore. And I thought the pick me up of that at the end, of that heartfelt ending, was such a delightful thing. And I just got to shout out the best Easter egg moment. Was Rocket getting that arm, Bucky's arm. He finally gets it, which is like, what?
It's incredible.
How does he get the arm? Who got the arm? I'm so good. I just thought that was such a perfect little moment. That it's such like a nice little nugget payoff for us fans. It's like, mm-hmm. if you remember, if you know, even this whole special of talking about Kevin Bacon and how Peter describes him. And that's all just Guardians 1, you know, that's all like mm-hmm. focused on all what he said in Guardians 1, which is so fun. Yeah. Anyway, this is a delightful thing.
Yeah. And, you know, before we get to the MCU-ness of it, James Gunn just has always done such a good job taking a ridiculous concept and adding so much weight to it without anybody even realizing that he's doing it. Like when Kraglin explains why Quill is such a Kevin Bacon fan, and it's because he heard that you saved, you know, a town through dance. And, you know, that's just Footloose. But right. like you look at Guardians 1, when you break down the nuts and bolts of it, classic Barstool Sports KFC radio thing is the meanest thing you can do to somebody is describe exactly what they did. You know, like, right. like you know, this podcast, we think it's very fun, very cool. If somebody were to come up to me and be like, so you just like talk to, you know, your friends about movies all day, like, you know, that's it. That's all you do. I'm like, yeah, that's really mean. Would he put it like that? But, you know, when you break down Guardians 1, he saved the universe through dance. And it's so ridiculous when you hear about it. But when you watch Guardians 1, wow, what a moment. You know, dance yep. off, bro. Yep. I love how they retroactively added weight to that. I think that everything from Quill, when they start lighting up nowhere, you know, with the Christmas lights, yes. like that's that and the music, that's that Christmas stuff that, you know, for whatever reason, you're just smiling because mm. it's like, that's Christmas and it's mm. awesome. I just thought all that was great. And then of course, Kevin Bacon's song at the end, really wrapping up that whole thing. It's just so, so committed to Christmas and I love it. Let's dive in really quickly to some MCU world building things that we got out of here because we got a lot of it. Obviously we got Cosmo the dog talking for the first time. She will be a big part of Guardians 3, I assume. You know, just another member of the team, Cosmo the dog, with telepathic powers. We're gonna dive into her. We're gonna dive into Rocket, you know, with what's his name? The Great Beyonder. Is that him? No, that's a bigger cosmic thing.
Who?
The Guardians 3 villain. I should know this.
I don't know.
Anyway, regardless. Cosmo the dog, I think something small that and a question that got answered here is, you know, all these guys were in Endgame together. They had that battle, but do they really know each other? Like, you know, like, or, you know, people want to get really into the thickness of it when they talk about things like Endgame, like, well, nobody knows Peter. Nobody knows Spider-Man. Well, you know, they were fighting in that battle together. Yeah, but they didn't see him. You know, it was too big of a space. You know, they were busy fighting all that stuff.
Right.
When Mantis runs up and jump tackles Steve, I think it confirms that after the battle between that and Tony's funeral, everybody hung out for a little while. You know, everybody got to know each other. We had a giant shawarma dinner with everybody in the in-game battle. You know, at least, you know, maybe not the armies, but, you know, because Mantis knowing who Steve is, that kind of confirms that for me a little bit.
That's a great point, actually. Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Because she never, on screen, they never had an interaction. One time.
But it had to be between Endgame right. and Tony's funeral. That's where it had to have right. gone down. I mean, the final battle, whatever. So that was kind of confirmed for me a little bit. Obviously, the big one, the biggest one, Mantis confirmed as Peter Quill's sister. At the end of this thing, a child of Ego, one of which we saw many of in Guardians 2. You know, we saw a whole cave of Ego children who didn't, you know, make the cut in his eyes. So that's very cool moment, I thought, very sweet between Mantis and Quill. And I think that, you know, adds just another layer of family into Guardians 3, which is pretty great.
Yeah.
And that is about it, unless I'm forgetting anything. Kraglin still doesn't have control over the arrow yet.
No. Yeah.
Drax
is wearing shirts.
You know, my nipples are too sensitive. No longer an issue for him.
Well, I thought of that as possibly a makeup decision.
Maybe. That very, very possible. He was wearing a shirt in Endgame as well for Tony's funeral. That I always thought that was a sign of respect. But
right.
now he's just wearing these shirts. And then one of them I forgot, which is huge. They bought nowhere from the collector.
That was okay. Yes. That was the thing I want to talk to you about. Right. Like that's mm-hmm. kind of a subtly. Yeah, exactly. Like it's like throw. Oh, yeah. Since we bought nowhere. Oh, because wow. I think going forward, it's kind of clear like the Guardians aren't this like. Not grounded. That's not the word I'm looking for.
They don't have a base.
Yeah, like, but I'm going for, they're not like this up and coming team. They are like well known, like they yes. are the Guardians. You know, yes. like it is a, and I think there was a line somewhere, where it's like, yeah, what was it?
It's Guardians remember? 2. You know, we're saving the galaxy again. Now we can charge twice as much. You know? Right. And it's Yondu. He's like, I'm not going to kill the Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah.
You know, over this much money or whatever. Like they're famous. They are famous.
But even in okay, that's what I was thinking of too. On top of all that, in Love and Thunder, like Thor's like, let the Guardians, like that's their thing, you know, like the Guardians are going to deal with their stuff. And that I think is cool, where it's like everyone in the galaxy kind of knows who they are and like they're, mm-hmm. they mean business. It's not like this ragtag simple team, like they are well respected, which is such a cool development from where we were in Guardians 1, which that is a movie I really want to rewatch after watching the holiday special, because it's been a while and I adore that film. And I know obviously you do too. With all that being said, Buying Nowhere, I think, kind of sets them up for in Guardians 3 being this kind of powerhouse. And then what happens with like Adam Warlock and all these things would be so interesting, because it's no longer, it's kind of a similar track, kind of like Avengers. But at this point, like by Infinity War, Endgame, even though they're shattered after Civil War, the Avengers are like this established thing that protects Earth, right? They're Earth's mightiest heroes. They defend the Earth. Yeah. Guardians kind of just guard all these different sections, you know, of the galaxy, obviously, that we don't know about. And then there's Captain Marvel happening too. But I think it'll be really interesting going forward in Guardians 3 to kind of see that power struggle and that power balance and like how really respected they are. And what it takes to kind of bring them down, because people are going down, I think, in that movie, you know, and it'll be interesting to see like how that all wraps up at the end. That's honestly the fact that this movie is being very blatantly marketed and talked about as the final chapter in the Guardians book that we know right now are Guardians since 2014. It's going to be so fascinating to see how they wrap this up, because we don't get movies like that normally in the MCU. They always leave the door open, and they will in this movie too, right? They'll leave doors open for the future of the franchise as the entire MCU unfolds and like other characters probably. But as just these characters in this moment, it'll be so fascinating to me coming off this holiday special, what they wrap up and how they do that, right? Like what are their goals? What is James Gunn's like final five pages of the script? What is his goal wrapping up his trilogy?
Right. I think it's going to be a combination of that. You know, how do we wrap up these characters? But also, do we get that Age of Ultron moment where, you know, we got some hitters? Not, there were no 27 Yankees, but we got some hitters.
Right.
And then there's Falcon, Vision, War Machine, Wanda, like the new Avengers are here.
Yeah.
So I wonder if we get that moment in the Guardians 3, but like back to just like the fame of the Guardians, I think you're right. You know, good call by you. It has been hinted at. I equate it, I think, to the people around the galaxy know about the Guardians the same way Han Solo knew about Boba Fett. He's a bounty hunter. He's for hire, but he's a famous bounty hunter. He's famously for hire. They're Benoit Blanc. Everybody knows who they are. I agree. That's a really cool thing to look out for. And then Buying Nowhere, and you know, Nebula has that, you know, line. It's going to be a while till this place is livable. They're turning Nowhere into like an inhabited place. People forget a severed head of a celestial. So Nowhere is going to come back at some point.
Which I think
Nowhere is another location now in the MCU that's more established.
And I thought the fart, like the wide shot of Nowhere looked a little brighter in this than we've seen it, where it was like super clear it was ahead. Like in the first movie, and we see Nowhere as a staple. We've been on Nowhere so many times.
Absolutely. I drafted it in the locations draft.
Yeah, exactly. Because it is a staple of the Guardian. It's a staple of just the Marvel universe at this point, because it's like such a gone back to place. But it was interesting. Yeah, exactly. And that's a huge scene. It's interesting. I thought one thing I want to touch on before we kind of wrap up here is like we did get that CGI space jumping for just a second, and that looks so cool. Like that looks so good. I thought like we kind of got that moment where it's like this is the Guardians. And above everything else, I think as a Marvel fan, besides just entertaining me for less than an hour on a Friday, this got me even more excited for Guardians 3. And I think, and if you want, we can kind of shift a little bit in the conversation. These special presentations are such a unique project they can keep building upon in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And I tweeted something out. It's gotten a lot of kind of feedback and conversation, which I love. I feel like a lot of times when I tweet, you tweet, whoever tweet, right? You're doing it to kind of sometimes start conversation. Like you throw out an opinion to then hear other, for other people to tell you that you're wrong or that you're right or that, oh, like that's an interesting take, you know? And I tweeted something out along the lines of basically saying that what I meant, I didn't say it exactly like this, but if I were to choose just presentations going forward or just shows, I would choose just presentations because I think they're in such a unique position to be perfect for what they want to be, right? Like, I think sometimes these shows, super hit or miss. And we've had a lot of them, you know? So if you boil it down, like, I had a lot of people replying, like, in the replies being like, oh, well, you know, Loki and WandaVision, they were good. That's not my point. My point wasn't that I wasn't trying to say that all of the shows have been bad. The presentations are two for two. Mm-hmm. And both of them, I think what the special sauce is, both of them feel perfect for what they're trying to do. I think I said the exact same thing for Werewolf by Night and this one, where for what they were trying to achieve, it's a 10 out of 10. You know, whatever that ceiling was, they hit it. And it's also just a unique situation where you sit down, one sitting, boom, that's it. It's not 2 hours. It's not a full-length movie, but we get another pocket of the MCU. It can move things forward a little bit. And there's so much untapped potential. It doesn't just have to be this seasonal thing. It doesn't have to be the Halloween Werewolf by Night, the Christmas Guardians of the Galaxy. This could be anything, you know? And I think that's a very unique, could be a unique way of using Disney Plus, especially going forward where, right? I mean, big picture ideas here. They're losing money on Disney Plus. These series cost a lot of money. Hey, James Gunn pumped this out while filming Guardians 3. You know, that's a good use of resources, in my opinion. And then you have this whole other thing to put on Disney Plus. My bottom line is I think that we could maybe see a ramp up in these specials and these special presentations, I should say, that are maybe marketed more as like a footnote in the MCU, a la the series are, less of like this just festive, you know, special, yeah. I guess, right? Where it's like maybe we do get the what's the rumored one? Nova. A Nova presentation, mm-hmm. or a Namor presentation,
Okoye
presentation, things like that, where it's just less than an hour with a character or with a pocket of the MCU that adds depth, pushes things forward. Like, imagine if it was an Ironheart special presentation. That would interest me a lot. I think after the movie, Wakanda Forever, a series does now too. Mm-hmm. But something like that, I mean, just imagine in the most hypothetical world ever, a special presentation of like Ned and MJ at MIT or something like that. You know, I think there's so much. It's a non-committal way of storytelling, in my opinion, right? It's not a 6-9 week long stretch. It's one sitting. You know, you sit down, you get it, you're out, and it's whatever it wants to be. And I'm pumped about it. I think there should be more of these. I think we should see more of a balance between the three. MCU exactly. Projects, movies, presentations, series. I think we should maybe dial back in the series just a little, right? Just where that's it. I think, in my opinion, we did get too many series in phase four. I feel like there was just so much where easy to get lost in the sauce, almost hard to kind of like follow everything to a T and like really dive into where we always had something else coming out. I don't want the MCU to get oversaturated, I guess, is my also bottom line there, too, which I think these special presentations could help. I mean, imagine if it was just a Moon Knight special presentation instead of a series. I think, in my opinion, that would have been better as just for me. But, you know, I think go back and forth on it. I just think it's an interesting idea, these special presentations going forward, because they've opened it up now. Like Marvel Studios has opened up this idea. And for someone like me, it excites me of what it could be. I enjoy what it is already, but the potential of it, I think, is so high.
I agree that the exponential potential of these special presentations is very high. I know you didn't mean it this way, but from a binary standpoint, I don't think that only special presentations would be better than only series. because you can get the pocket benefits of a special presentation within a series, plus so much more. Yes, there's more opportunity to have down weeks where people get down on the show and then in turn the MCU as a whole because you're more committed. But think about the, like, and again, I know this isn't what you're saying, but hypothetically, say every show so far was a 50-minute special presentation. We don't get Monica Rambeau. We don't get John Walker. We don't get, you know, Kang the way we got Kang in Loki. You know, that was a 20-minute dialogue. You can't do that in a special presentation. There are so many benefits to both. And going back to what I said earlier, I think the only thing that makes me hesitant about, like, I don't want to just believe every special presentation is going to be great because the first two have been great. The first two have committed to a very niche genre and tone gone 150% at that 30s noir holiday special. How many times can you do that before you run out of niche genres to tackle? Now, that's not to be said. I think that you just got to pick your spots if you're Marvel Studios. You need to pick and choose what will work better as a special presentation and what will work better as a series. I don't think it's going to kind of overtake series. I do think we're going to get more of a blend. We talked about this last week, I think, or maybe 2 weeks ago, how the fact that we got 7 series in 2 years, I do think that is COVID related, where we had planned on 3 years to release 7 series. We got 2. I feel the congestedness. I feel the packed overexpanding of the MCU. I do think we're going to trail off that a little bit as we go. But I do think, like, certain projects will work better as special presentations and others will work better at series. That's going to be the next thing. Now that they have this tool, are they going to utilize it the best they can? Are they going to pick the right ones to go into the right formats? Agatha, Coven of Chaos sounds like a perfect special presentation to me instead of a series. It's going to be a series, at least as of now, but I do think it sounds like a better special presentation. Armor Wars, obviously, it's been promoted to a movie. I think it would have been a really great special presentation because we've seen two types now, right? Not just horror and holiday special. We've seen an origin story introducing a character into the MCU, and we've seen kind of a prequel to a movie in this holiday special. You know, it's kind of resetting the characters before their big movie. There's a lot of different utilitarian uses for these special presentations. I think the challenge isn't going to be, I think it's going to be less of, well, we need to do more special presentations or we need to do less series. It's going to be picking and choosing which characters and which stories fit better in each pocket. Imagine a special presentation part 1, part 2, you know, that kind of thing, you know. Yes. Like that's the kind of stuff. Well, David, what about a part 1 through 6 special presentation?
See, that's,
you know, when yeah. that play? But I just think that I think it's easy to look at these first two special presentations and think, wow, they should have been doing this for so many different things. I think there's a little bit more nuance into picking and choosing simply because the tone, for at least for me, the tone has carried these things so far into me, my enjoyment of them. You know what I mean? Like, obviously you couldn't do an entire series of black and white 30s noir for Werewolf by Night. If you're going to do the 30s noir thing, make it a special presentation. It just allows for more opportunity, like you said. And I think from a character standpoint, it's going to be really interesting to see how they pick and choose which ones fall under which pocket.
I do think there's one thing with the special presentations that I think is exciting, that both have been consistent up, is they tell like one story, if that makes sense. It's like a short story. And I think that
no B plot.
Right, exactly. That's what excites me, because I think, in my opinion, where a lot of the Marvel shows have lost some of the audiences are those extra characters, those extra things happening. We're just getting kind of the meat in these presentations when we don't need to expand. You know, like Werewolf by Night didn't have to be a 6-part series. The holiday special is totally its own thing. It's the Guardians of the Galaxy. It's kind of its own idea.
But established IP.
I just think in general, the idea, and I am not, look, I'm with you. I just want a more balanced mix. And I think we will get that as things sort out. I think in general, actually, we might get less shows and Disney Plus content overall because of possible budget cuts that makes sense for the company. And we'll see. Looking back, that could look so out of whack, though. If you know, looking back to the last couple of years, like we said, 7 projects, and like going forward, I just think there's some characters that Kevin Feige may want to explore that could best be suited for a 40 to 50 minute presentation where it is just one story, like Werewolf by Night. you know, or some other new character. And I want them to consider, I hope they start to consider these presentation style projects for anything, right? I know they don't stay in the press and in the mind's eye of audience members as much when it's a presentation. Like I think Disney does shrewdly put these things out 1 week at a time because they want it to stay in the news cycle. And I get that. But I also think that sometimes, and that's happened over the last year or so, audience members have kind of gotten some more general casual fans have definitely gotten lost in it. They can't keep up. They don't want to keep up. You know, they'll go see Wakanda Forever. They'll go see Doctor Strange, but they don't want to tune in every week to all these shows. So I think the one thing that Marvel's been doing lately, for better or for worse, has kind of been whittling down those more super-ish fans, you know, those fans that really care, to the casuals. Because I noticed in my life, you know, there's people that would still consider themselves like, oh, I definitely want to go see No Way Home, Doctor Strange, you know, Wakanda Forever. But they didn't watch every episode of Moon Knight or She-Hulk and any of this, and they don't have any intention to. So it's interesting going forward, I think, how they'll manage that and how much those Disney Plus shows will then affect the movies, because they have already. You know, they are very open. Obviously, WandaVision, Doctor Strange. Now, you know, the inverse of that, Wakanda Forever setting up Riri Williams. As a fan, for us, it's cool, but I wonder if there will ever be any kind of, like, overwhelming backlash, or we'll notice at the box office, you know, where the numbers really matter.
Yeah, it's gonna be something to see. I'm excited to see how they go. And people also got to remember, we have done one phase of Disney Plus projects. It's a learning curve. You know, there are things that are going to adjust moving into phase five, as they should.
Yeah.
People forget one shots existed in the MCU for years, and then they didn't exist for like 5 years, and then they retooled them, and now they're special presentations. So like the evolution of these different routes of media from Marvel Studios is something that they're always going to be tweaking and fine tuning. And, you know, look at the movies. The Marvel formula was the biggest critique of the MCU throughout phase two. Oh, you're just trying to repeat everything you did in phase one. Look what they did in phase three, taking so many more big swings and telling new, different kind of creative stories. It's going to evolve. Series are going to get better. And if nothing else, it's going to be because they now have a second option for characters they want to use. Not really worth a movie. It's not big enough for, you know, 6 weeks of a show, special presentation. It's all about just finding the hook and the right director to bring it to life. That's going to be another big thing. It's going to be a farm system for directors too.
Yeah.
In the same way the Russos had to audition with Winter Soldier, balancing Cap, Falcon, Natasha, Nick Fury, Bucky, and then Civil War, showing that you can take every Earth-based hero and do it in one thing. Those were auditions for Infinity War, where every character comes together finally. I think that's going to happen here with special presentations, same way WandaVision was an audition for Matt Shackman, who now has Fantastic Four. Moving on to The Glass Onion. Review, that was a little abrupt, but we enjoyed the holiday special. We're very excited. Guardians 3, my most anticipated movie of 2023. The Direct.com's most anticipated movie of 2023. Check out that article over on The Direct. Very, very fun one I got to write up. But here we go. Ryan Johnson, he's kind of in the universe as you love, right? Star Wars director. Glass Onion review.
Let it all out.
Hell yeah!
This is reckless. The killer wouldn't hesitate to kill again if it covers their tracks.
Here we go. One of our first steps outside of the universes you love. You know, we have Marvel, DC, Star Wars, Game of Thrones are our official brands here on The Direct. We did Top Gun Maverick as a review earlier this year, and now our second non-universe movie review. Kind of a universe, though. Knives Out, Glass Onion, the sequel to the hit murder mystery show, movie, I should say, Knives Out, directed by Ryan Johnson, the director of the best of the sequel trilogy. I only kid. here we go. Glass Onion. Overall thoughts, David. We're going to get into spoilers just organically throughout this one. So if you haven't seen it, pause. Come back and we will review this movie for you. But David, just your kind of brief overall thoughts on Glass Onion.
Yeah, I thought it was good. I had a fun time in the theater with it. I don't think it was as good as the first one. If just kind of throw that out there, if you're still here and you haven't seen it, like those wouldn't be my expectations. It's very different from the first one. We're in Greece. It's a little more lively. The characters, the relationships are totally different. But at the end of the day, in my opinion, Daniel Craig is so good in this character. He is so good as Benoit Blanc, right? This detective. And the cast is really good. I do have some very critical thoughts about how they utilize some of the cast, and I'll get to that. But in general, once the kind of onion gets peeled back of what's really happening here, we're getting the flashback. We're getting the different point of view perspective on what's really going on. Because in the first half of the movie, I'm sitting there like, where's the content? Like, what's happening? You know, and I knew it was coming. I knew there's going to be some, I hoped there'd be this kind of moment. And there is, right? We get to go back and kind of relive everything from a different perspective and really see what's going on, which is always a fun thing to do. I thought Edward Norton was great. He was a standout to me. And then Janelle Monáe, who is the other actress who plays two characters, twins, which is always a fun thing. You know, that's when you know someone can act, when they can do that. And it's switching back and forth. It's, and in this movie, it's playing the one sister, then playing the other one that also acts like the first sister. So it's a great little thing, and you buy it the whole way. You feel the difference. You can almost, like, that's what's honestly amazing about the performance, that you can tell the difference between, I forget the Andy. Yeah, there's Andy.
It's Cassandra, and then starts with an R.
Helen is her.
Helen. Sister, yeah, right? You're right.
So there's Cassandra, who's AKA Andy, who's kind of like sister 1A, right? And you could honestly, I think in her performance, tell the difference between when there's those little scenes of actually Andy in like the flashbacks to when Helen is acting like Andy, I think is like, that's money. that's great performance. It was good. I'm curious your thoughts, because to me, I walked out, it was a late showing. It was like these nice seats, reclining. Oh, great time. And I was like, that was fun. That was good. I don't think it was as good as the first one. I think it wasn't as satisfying maybe. As the first one, but I thought it was a good time, and I'm excited to see like the next one. I'm glad I saw it in a theater too. I tweeted that out. Like, I'm glad, like, go check it out in the theater if you can, because I think my theater was packed. We were laughing. We're having a good time. And you won't get that at home on Netflix. You'll be pausing. The dog will need to go out. You'll be TikTok, whatever, Twitter, you know, work. Go see it in the theater.
Go see it in theaters. No, I echo everything you said. I had watched the first Knives Out earlier this week. Me and Aaron did. Before we went and saw Glass Onion, because I only saw it once when it first came out on VOD, and I didn't even realize it was Rian Johnson who did it until the very end of the movie. first time I saw it. So I think that I hate doing this right away. I enjoyed this movie immensely. I had such a good time with it. I love the style and tone that they've kind of turned up. It's kind of a Guardians 1, Guardians 2 thing for me, where they took the most fun parts about Guardians 1 and then just turned it all up to 11 for Guardians 2.
Mm-hmm.
And for better or for worse, there's pros and cons to that, but
right.
I think that's what this one did, where they kind of just went a little more all in on the almost parody of, you know, the murder mystery. And mm-hmm. It's sillier, it's more fun, it's more bombastic, it's more eccentric and stylized than Knives Out is. You know, Knives Out, you know, we're in a mansion and it's just one family and we're all just, this one is an island in Greece and these giant sets and these over the top characters and
big glass onion
costumes in this thing, man.
The
wardrobe department crushed this entire movie, and it's all just more stylized, more extreme. I enjoyed all of that. You do lose, the satisfaction is the word I've been looking for since I saw it last night. The mystery is better, I think, in the first one. It has that moment. It has that second moment in Knives Out where it's the twist, double twist, you know, with the vials and Ana de Armas and Chris Evans, their performances together is the twist, double twist of the whole thing.
Right.
Something I forgot, though, something I was trying to like, man, this is way more silly than the first one. And then I remembered Ana de Armas's character in the first one. Every time she lies, she projectile vomits. Like, that's silly. that's a very silly thing. They kind of took that concept and turned it up.
Yeah.
A little bit for Glass Onion. So I prefer the first one more because the mystery is better. The second one, I laughed the whole time. My entire theater laughed the whole time. It was so much more fun. Another thing I like is they didn't try to recreate the same kind of mystery from the first one. They weren't trying to give you a twist, double twist again. What they were trying to do was, like you said, tell you the story and then go back and fill in all the holes. That's a totally different style of mystery that I really appreciated in this one. Rashomon style is what it's called. I only know that because I wrote the Deadpool 3 article. But I just think that the mystery was different, but still really good. The characters over the top, and I loved every second of it. David, who was your favorite character in this movie?
That's a great question.
Besides Blanc, of course.
Yeah, I'll avoid Blanc. I think it might be Miles, who is Edward Norton in this film. He, I think, does a great job of just, like, spoilers. He is, like, the bad guy, the killer. But I think what's interesting about this movie is that, like, kind of obvious, and that they say that, you know, it's always right in front of you, you know, it's so stupid. It's so silly. Yeah. I love how he goes through that. But I thought his acting and performance in that character was maybe just the most entertaining on screen. I think Andy/Helen, I think, was the most they were given the most. They were kind of the Ana de Armas of this one, let's say, quote unquote. Right. They're kind of given the most. They're our hero, you know. So I liked them. But I think I was most entertained by Miles Edward Norton, just like his little isms and like even like the flashback with the long hair and all of that. I do want to, before we, I don't know, as we're sitting on the characters, I do just want to say one criticism I had driving home last night was, and I'm talking to my fiance, who is a huge Knives Out 1 fan, super excited for this movie. She was a giant Knives Out 1 fan, like loves that movie. It was that, and what I said then, and I'll say it again now, I don't think at all the actors, and specifically Catherine Hahn, were given enough room to just strut, man. I don't think they were given enough. Specifically Leslie Odom, Catherine Hahn, and I guess Kate Hudson too. But I think specifically Catherine Hahn and Leslie Odom weren't given enough playground to play around, like sandboxes to play in. Like they weren't given enough, and I think those characters in general were all pretty thin, in my opinion. We didn't learn much about, and in the end too, consequences wise, they don't have any. First they side with Miles in court, and now it's like, ooh, we're gonna flip to Andy/Helen's side, and then that's just that. Like, to me, that was the kind of, it's a criticism that I think Rian Johnson might take on the chin, because that's the way he almost wanted to present it, in my opinion. Like, these aren't these well fleshed out characters. They're just these literal just characters along for the ride, you know? And I think this movie is entertaining because it is so unique in that sense. It's like this weird band of disruptors, quote unquote. All these characters thrown on, and we learn about why they're together and kind of like how they're all shitty, you know, which I like. I like the idea of that. We're like, no one's really good besides Helen, pretty much, and Blanc in this movie. And I just thought,
and Whiskey, don't throw my girl Whiskey under the bus.
Whiskey, that's right, Outer Banks. I thought she was good. I liked her. I liked that her kind of playing like the, I don't know, not damsel in
distress. Stoner girlfriend.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of dumb, funny, and just but innocent in the same way. Dave Bautista's fine. I thought he was actually pretty good in this.
So I want to jump in on that real quick. I agree that Leslie Odom and Catherine Hahn are underutilized, especially because we know what Catherine Hahn can bring to the table, right?
Exactly.
I think Kate Hudson got the Catherine Hahn role, and I think she crushed it. I love Kate Hudson in this. So over the top, just so funny. I think I'd never seen Kate Hudson be that funny. It's Kate Hudson, right? I'm not crazy. her mask being a net mask, you know, like a
stylist. That was so funny.
Hilarious.
She was funny.
Yeah. And like every time anything happens, she's screaming at the top of her lungs. And that's, you know, that's more of that parody of murder mystery thing.
What is reality?
It is reality.
That got me. That was so funny.
I thoroughly enjoyed. I agree that Leslie Odom and Catherine Hahn surprisingly took a back seat to Dave Bautista and Kate Hudson in this, because both of their characters I thought were the most fleshed out and the most entertaining because they were given funny things to say. I tell you what, I laughed so hard when they were all showing up on that bridge and Bautista shows up on this Harley and we think it's the back shot from the Harley making those pop sounds, but there's Whiskey holding a pistol up in the air as she rolls up. They were just shooting a gun up in the air on their way through the bridge. I thought that was so funny. But no, I agree that Catherine Hahn and Leslie Odom were the backseat characters of this. I do appreciate how they took over from the first one, how Ana de Armas was kind of the Watson for Blanc in that first one. Mm-hmm. Same thing with Helen in this. I thought that was very cool. I agree. Edward Norton steals every scene he's in. He's great.
That's it.
You know, yeah. He's very eccentric and awesome. The whole speech about him just being an idiot, I thought was brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, like going back all of his made up words and, you know, how his murder mystery really wasn't even that good. And then it turns out he didn't write it. He didn't plan it. He didn't do any of that.
He is an idiot.
No. It's not. No, it's just stupid. He's just stupid. I thought all that was great. And then even, you know, beyond that, you know, the idea of the glass onion, you know, what a weird title for a movie, right? I didn't know what that meant. The fact that they did a really good job teaching us what that phrase means. I don't know if it was a phrase before this movie. I assume it is. But the idea of something being a glass onion is something that appears to have all this depth and appears to have all these layers and likes to present itself as a, you know, more deep thing than it is. But in reality, you can see right through the middle of it. You know, it's very transparent. That being exemplified in Edward Norton's character with this glass onion speech that he has, I thought that was awesome. There's my satisfaction that I wanted in this, that I thought was very, very cool. I agree that it, you know, the ending wasn't as satisfying where everybody just kind of turns and nobody has any repercussions. Aaron had a really good point, my wife, when we watched it last night. This giant explosion is supposed to end this alternative fuel thing, but no one dies. You know, like that. That was the ending was a little bit of a down beat when it should have been an upbeat, which is tough. But, you know, no movie's perfect, right? Whereas in the last one, you had the twist, the double twist, the fact that Ana de Armas is getting the entire inheritance and then the backlash of that. Like that was a little bit more of a stronger ending.
I said on the drive home, because we're talking about it, obviously, and I don't know if I said it on the podcast, but I had to drive like an hour to see this movie because it had a smaller release to Orlando. And driving back, it's late at night, and I'm like, you know what? It was missing, because you have to compare it to the original, right? It's what you do. And it didn't have the Ana de Armas on the porch with the coffee moment. God, that's the most satisfying thing, and that's such a good moment. It's like that is like movie magic, and I think it was missing. Like, I love that comp you had of like Guardians 1 to 2, where it like really exemplified and like rose up all like the fun about it. But I think the meat of the story and the plot and the characters weren't as good. The acting and performances were awesome though, all around. I just wish personally Odom Hahn had more room to strut, especially Catherine Hahn, because I thought, and Jasmine's in my ear during the film, she's like, I bet it's the governor, you know, I bet it's her, because like she's like the politician.
What a great heel turn that would have been,
right? And like I'd love to see the Agatha all along twist once again. I'd love to see Catherine Hahn enter that mode. God, that would have been great. Honestly, if Rian Johnson had like done that and started playing the music, I would have been like, all right, I'm down. just do it.
And she winks. Glass Onion, I think overall me and David share the opinion of it. I, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's more fun than the first one, but maybe not as good. But they're both great. I had such a good time with both these movies. And, you know, like you said, the performances, the characters, like the characters, I think were better than the first one. It's how they use them that I think is a little weaker in spots. You know what I mean? It's an interesting thing to talk about with this murder mystery thing. And like you said earlier, I couldn't be more excited for Benny Blanc's next case.
Right.
You know, that's what this has turned into. I cannot wait to see Daniel Craig back as Benoit Blanc doing another case with another star-studded cast. And, you know, I think both of these movies have such great names behind each cast, and it elevates it so much, and it's just figuring out what the right mystery is. This one got a little bit overblown with, oh, so every house in America is going to turn into the Hindenburg. A little bit more extreme than someone killed my dad.
Right.
So I'm excited to see kind of how they balance that out for Knives Out 3. David, buddy, pal, friend, guy. Mm-hmm. If you had to pick one or two actors you want to see in Knives Out 3 along with Daniel Craig, who would it be?
Stealing this one from Klein Felt, our friend from TheDirect.com. He posted something along the lines, like a few actors. Adam Driver was on that list or one of the photos.
Oh, perfect.
I would love Adam.
He's ideal for this.
Yeah, like he seems, that would be such perfect casting. My other one is Margot Robbie. Yep. I would love to see her in something like this. I think she'd be outstanding in one of these movies. Beyond that, what's another one I'd like to see? Mark Ruffalo, I'd like to see. I think he would be fun.
Or see him play a dick. He's never done it.
Yeah, that could be good. I like how squirrely he is in some of his performances. Mm-hmm. Have you seen Spotlight?
I have. Great movie.
Like, he's such a great... I love his performance in that. He's just so, like, beady-eyed and all over the place. And I'd love to see that kind of character, like that kind of, like, itchy, like, character in this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think of who else I could maybe, like... Going off of Batista, John Cena would be fun. I could see him playing a similar character.
Yeah, definitely.
And then, you know who I don't want in the next one? The Rock. Ooh. Sorry.
Sure. No, I get that. The Rock wouldn't be in it because he wouldn't be the lead.
True.
He wouldn't do it. I love Batista's character in this. I thought everything Batista did was so funny.
Although he was like a gamer Twitch guy. That was great.
And then this like Mandem dude. You know, like, I always have my gun with me. You know, like, his whole speech about boobs at the beginning. Like, listen, boobs give us so much. Life, milk, all these things. Hey, let's be honest. Boobs are fun. You know, boobs are a good time. And, you know, I stand by it. Other than babies and puppies, I think boobs are the most universally beloved thing in the world. No one doesn't love boobs. So I think Batista did a really good job nuancely, you know, displaying that message. Actors I want to see. I'll steal another one from Kleinfeld. Michael Keaton. He needs to be the... Jamie Lee Curtis, Edward Norton of the third one. I think he'd be perfect. And then I have one requirement. Like, this isn't a want. This is a need. I need it to happen. And it's Elizabeth Olsen. Elizabeth Olsen, I think, would be perfect for this. She could play a character that is so out of left field for everybody who only knows her as Wanda. You know what I mean? Like she could do what Kate Hudson did and just blow up with her performance and play this crazy off the walls character. I think that would be awesome for everybody involved. I think she's another person that just looks perfect for something like this.
Yeah. I would love that.
Yeah. So maybe Lizzie Olsen and Adam Driver. That'd be hot.
Ooh, I love that.
Yeah. So ladies and gentlemen, that has been Glass Onion, and that has been an entire podcast. One thing we did not mention from the Guardians review, I do want to bring back real quick. One, another Batman reference. Always very cool to see in the MCU when they mentioned Batman comics. You know, Kevin Bacon says, I'm not Batman. I'm not Bruce Wayne. You know, who's Bruce Wayne? Like, I love that.
Yeah.
Also, you know, most of the Suicide Squad has had roles in the MCU as well. Confirmed canon in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Margot Robbie and John Cena on the stars map.
I know.
They go to Margot's house and John Cena's house. So,
mm-hmm.
That's a very cool thing. Ladies and gentlemen, that has been episode 123 of the Direct Podcast. We did not get to the wheel of the fantastic. We'll bring that back next week. But until then, welcome to Mondays for the Direct Podcast for the remainder of this year and until Disney Plus has a show. And we will see you back next Monday for episode 124. Very excited. We'll see you then.
Santa is a furry freak with epic superpowers. Flies to every human.
out.